This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Here's another Saturday Magazine podcast brought to you by Joy sponsor, Virgin Australia. Visit virginaustralia.com.
A unique mix of world news and queer culture, Saturday Magazine, every Saturday, 10 till 12, on Joy 94.9.
Saturday Magazine, Joy 94.9, Macca and Tass, go for it.
Thank you, Macca. Macca, just to pick up on some of the issues that we've been already talking about, we've deliberately asked Leslie Podesta to come into the studio this morning and have a discussion with us about some of the work that the Foundation's doing, in particular around its work on advocacy around gun laws in Australia. Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning, team.
Good morning. Great to have you in the studio. Thank you for coming in. So the Alana and Madeline Foundation was set up after the massacre in Port Arthur in 1996, if that serves me correct. Walter Micak lost his two daughters, Alana and Madeline. The foundation is named in their honour after them. And it was set up by their father, I believe.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It's, you know, the Alana and Madeline Foundation is, I think, the symbol for the world, how you respond to a massacre. There were two things that came out of Port Arthur, which, you know, ironically, after this week, the anniversary is next month.
Yes.
There were 35 people who lost their lives. You know, Alana and Madeline were 6 and 3 years old, and they were hunted down by the perpetrator and killed in front of their mum. Walter woke up the next morning, and it was his birthday.
Yeah.
And
he
woke up to a completely silent house, and there was a birthday card by the kids in the drawer next to the bed for him. And he says, you know, he fell to his knees and he said, you know, God, couldn't you have left me just one? And I don't know how many people can recover from that. It's, you know, the most extraordinary thing. He said he'd, you know, the last 6 years had been waking up to the morning, you know, in the morning of cartoons, and you wake up to that after seeing the bodies of his babies and his partner, Nanette. But he also said that he refused to give in to hatred, and that what he wanted was that he wanted no child to feel the fear that his little girls had felt in the last moments of their lives. And so Alana and Madeline Foundation was named to remember his children and to say that we're going to be a potent force for keeping children safe from violence, and for children who have experienced violence to help them recover from that violence and be able to be children again.
So tell us a bit about the work that you do. How do you translate that objective into the work that you're actually doing day to day?
Yes, it's a very wide remit. And one of the things that we do is we work across Australia. And when we started, we really focused on physical violence, as you would imagine. And Walter was a potent force for gun laws. And I will talk about why we now work around gun laws again 23 years later, because most people thought it was fixed after the gun laws were passed. So the work that the foundation commenced with was an immediate support for children who'd been affected by violence, and that's work that we continue today. So we have a program called Children Ahead, which is a therapeutic support for children affected by violence. We have, at any one time, 30 children who we have had referred primarily through police and victim support services. And I'll just break your heart again. We have 30 children. They're all primary school children. 8 of the children witnessed the murder of their parent.
Oh, my God.
The majority of them have lost a parent. So they're children who've had extraordinary trauma in their lives. And what we do is we, on a weekly basis, we work with those children and their carers, and importantly their teachers, so that they can support them. We provide physical and material aid for those kids. And we have a fantastic track record. Mostly we support those children for an average of 2 years, because little kids need a lot of love and care to get back to being able to be little kids and trust again. And we also support the people who are caring for them, often who are incredibly traumatised by the circumstances by which, in many cases, it's the grandchildren who came to their lives. But we also provide material aid for kids across the country, children who are removed from home because they're at risk of violence. So we have a backpack, but it sounds like nothing, but it's extraordinary. It's a backpack full of pajamas, underwear, toys, toiletries, books, in a fabulous, cool backpack, which we market test with kids all the time, so we make sure they're the ones that they like. And they go out for free to over 450 organisations across the country. And so far, we have given 93,000 backpacks to kids, and it's completely free. They go to kinship care, to domestic violence services, anywhere where a child might be brought in a circumstance where they have nothing.
So, Leslie, if you don't support these children at this point when they are very young, what are the implications and what are the long-term impacts of that? Do they end up with post-traumatic stress disorder when they hit 40 and 50?
Absolutely. So that kind of trauma at a very early point is such a strong indicator of other risk factors for kids. You know, being detached from adults, not being able to form friendships, having long-term mental health consequences, not being able to thrive at school, not being able to bond with the person who is caring for them, not trusting people, and often acting out in ways that are also make it difficult for them to form friends. So not being able to talk sometimes, or being very disruptive in class or around their friends. So these are kids who have had a big, big shock in their system, and they need love and care to be able to be children again and be successful as children. That's our objective. The other big area of work that we do is we do bullying prevention, and we do across the country. We run the National Centre Against Bullying, where we bring experts. And I say that because this is an area of social policy which is absolutely populated by well-meaning people who have no evidence base. And we work very carefully to work only with people with deep research method and a proven methodology. There's just so much fish oil sold in the name of bullying, which drives us crazy, because there's great evidence about how you can reduce bullying with the right intervention and the right support. And bullying is a really important part of the work we do, because bullying is such a prevalent part of childhood, but also it has a deeper reason for us. As you know, we were formed out of this massacre, and you've seen in the US, and we'll talk a little bit longer about what it means to have so many guns in a community. There is a direct relationship between those people who pick up weapons and want to do harm to people in a random, angry way, and people who have been bullied or were bullied as children. Now, I'm not saying it's exactly immediate, but you look at, there is enough patterning,
enough of a link,
to be able to show that too often, when particularly young men are in the position where they have been bullied and then they go on to bully others, the anger, the lack of empathy that is developed at that point in their lives can often boil over. And you look at the Columbine kids, you look at the Port Arthur, you look at others, there is a very strong pattern about alienation and not being able to build relationships within their peer group and resolve that kind of anger and isolation.
So are you saying that those children might grow up to then become adults who inflict bullying or violence on other people?
We know that the evidence is really clear that children who have been bullied or bullied as teenagers are more likely to be involved in domestic violence, for example, and into violence and in interrelationship violence as they get older, yes.
Can I ask, Leslie, you know, I understand and I accept that link, and that it's based on evidence, which is what we need, you know, when we're dealing with these issues. How can we as Australia, or how can some people in Australia, even be thinking about wanting, not just have a discussion, wanting to change our gun laws? How can we possibly be at the point where this discussion gets some currency with some politicians? And I'm not just talking about the nutbag politicians. I'm talking about politicians that actually should know better, that have been in Parliament a while, that may or may not have been ministers, have access to information. How can we? How can this even get some currency? Saturday Magazine, Joy 94.9, Macca and Tass.
So, Leslie, let's kick off with Macca's question. Macca, I wanted to ask you, why is it that there are politicians who are invested in watering down our gun laws? But before you do that, is it correct that there are now more guns floating about in Australia than there were back in 1996, even after the probably the most stringent gun laws in the world?
Yes, it is true. And that the question is related to the other question. Follow the money, you know, and it's a simple maxim, but it's true. The reason that the NRA exists is because gun manufacturers want to sell more guns. They are one of the most profitable industries in the world. And the only way that you sell more guns is to constantly increase demand for guns. So what we have in Australia is we still have an incredibly small proportion of households that own guns, but people increasingly have a much larger cache of guns. They have more guns. And within different states, it varies about the arrangements that are in place around how much time you have to have in between requesting a gun license and being able to acquire.
So every state and territory has different gun laws?
Not in theory, but in practice, yes. And we'll just go through the National Firearms Agreement 101, shall we? So, because it's complicated and it's important to understand, and it's important to understand why politicians are able to make inroads into weakening our gun laws. So the National Firearms Agreement is based on three principles, and they're still really important principles, and they're still really important platforms that have remained in Australia. The first one is that guns need to be registered. You need to know what guns exist in our country and what type of guns can be imported into our country. There's a classification system, and the importation of guns is a responsibility of the federal government. That's why we have a National Firearms Agreement. They have the... But the licensing, which is the second principle, is run by the states. The National Firearms Agreement came into place, which was to make uniformity across the states and territories around the way that they would license gun owners, so that they would all states would sign up to the same principles, and then they would legislate to bring all of their licensing arrangements into line. That has never taken place. Every state is
different.
They made a lot of changes, but there's still differences. And what we've seen since the National Firearms Agreement was signed and delivered after Port Arthur was, look, the most important principles. We don't have semi-automatic weapons. We don't have automatic weapons in our country. You have to be licensed. You have to have a genuine need to have a firearm in Australia. So one of the other principle of the Firearms Agreement is that you don't have a right to a gun. It's a conditional privilege. But
that's very unlike the Americans who believe that it is their right to have a gun.
Absolutely. And, that amendment is just a ridiculous... The NRA and the firearms industry has...
So what's a reasonable situation to have a gun in Australia?
In Australia, if you have an occupational need, so that if you are a farmer, for example, and you have feral animals that you need to be able to shoot, if you need to be able to protect yourself because you're at risk, you might have foxes or dingoes on your property that could hurt your sheep. If you are a registered member of a sporting shooters club, it's your sport, and there are legitimate reasons, and your reasons then can determine what type of license you're able to get and what sort of firearm you're able to get. What we've seen, and this is in answer to your first question, is because states have so much power about who can get guns, has been a significant increase in the number of people who have been elected into state parliaments who use their position as crossbenchers to be able to negotiate and trade off gun laws in exchange for their vote on other things. Just as you saw in the program this week, it's their way of working, has always been their way of working.
So that's exactly what One Nation were trying to do.
Absolutely.
On their visit to the NRA in the US.
To do it on a national level. What One Nation's proposal is that you bring all of the laws to the federal level, which means you then get chance to change everything.
Change it.
That would be, I have to say, it just shows how naive that would be such an impossible thing to do in Australia. States would never give up their right to do that. But Let me give an example of New South Wales. So New South Wales has had shooters in their crossbench for some time. I am terrified of what's going to happen in New South Wales now, because you've got Latham, you've got David Lynham elected, so their upper house looks very tightly balanced, and you've got some people who are very, very pro-gun. So New South Wales has progressively sliced away at the National Firearms Agreement. So here is the perfect example. The National Firearms Agreement says that you need to apply and then you have to wait for 28 days before you get a license. And the arrangement is that when you get a gun license, if you want another gun license, you have to apply and wait 28 days. There's no waiting period in New South Wales. So in New South Wales, effectively, you can apply and you get it the next day. If you've already been assessed as being eligible for a gun license, you can get it again. Which has meant that, and these are police figures, not our figures, there are individuals in New South Wales, in suburban New South Wales, in Manly, in Balmoral, with 300 and 400 guns in their home.
Yeah.
Whoa.
So you now have people living in suburban areas with massive caches of guns. And, you know, we talk all the time about extremism and crime. I'm sorry, but having 400 guns in a suburban home in Leichhardt, that is one of the most terrifying prospects for me.
In 1987...
Macaram, just to let our listeners know who we're speaking with.
Yeah, sure. So, Leslie Podesta from the
Alana and Madeline.
Alana and... Oh, I'm really tongue-tied.
It's the Alana and Madeline Foundation.
Yeah. In 1987, the Hoddle Street Massacre. Mm-hmm. Straight after that, I actually was a sporting shooter, not at live things, at targets. And I was actually pretty good at it. But I surrendered my gun. I surrendered my gun licence. Because even though I enjoyed doing that in a controlled environment, I thought, you know, this actually isn't a sport. Right? Those who shoot at animals say that's a sport. Well, give the animals a gun and let them shoot at you and see how sporting you think that is. But I've never, and from that time, I've never understood, right, you know, the deputy leader of the Federal National Party, Bridget McKenzie, is a sporting shooter, a rootin' tootin' shootin' gnat. Right?
She's the convener of the Friends of Guns as
well. Yeah. Now, you know, you believe in sporting shooting, Bridget? Well, tell us what is sporting about it, because I was a sporting shooter and I never thought there was any sporting about it. I don't understand why... I understand the political pressure that is brought in this area, Leslie, but at the end of the day, how can we even be having the discussion post-Christchurch... right, about changing
so
gun laws.
So what stimulated this, Leslie? Yeah, like, what stimulated this?
Have these people gone completely and utterly mad? Or was, you know, like, why?
So I'm going to turn this on its head. I think that the expose this week is fantastic, because nobody in Australia pretty much runs on a platform anymore of, if you elect me, I'm going to change gun laws. It is hidden now.
Of course.
And that is because...
Even with the Shooters and Fishers Party?
The Shooters and Fishers did not mention gun control, guns, or relaxation of guns whatsoever in the New South Wales election. They ran on water in Menindee. They ran on what was happening in water. This is the new way of doing this for the gun lobby, which is that you find hot button issues and you get candidates who you know are going to back you, who actually you are funding. They're your candidates, but they don't talk about gun control. And so I am delighted that this issue has got some light on it, because we know, as people who work very hard to keep the National Firearms Agreement in place, is that we have to constantly put a light on the people whose objective is absolutely... You heard the guy who's going to run as a Senate candidate in Queensland. He said guns are still going to be the be-all and end-all. That's what he said, and that is the reality. They don't talk about it. They talk about electricity prices, etc. They talk about... But guns are the be-all and end-all. It's about the money, and the money that they're getting from this industry is phenomenal. I know you all know this, but just in case you don't, the largest importer of guns in Australia is Robert Noah. He's Bob Catter's son-in-law. He's the largest donor to the Catter's Australia
Say that again, slowly, so everybody can hear us.
So the,
no, we didn't know that.
Yes, the largest importer of guns in Australia is Robert Noah. He has the biggest industry. He has massive contracts in Australia with, and he is Bob Catter's son-in-law, and he is the largest, his industry, his company is the largest individual donor to Catter's Australia Party. I think the last time I looked, I think it was $800,000 they've donated. Yes. But, you know, who is funding One Nation? There's Shooters, there's the Liberal Democrats, and there's Catter. We've got a lot of people who've got very strong links. But we also saw other organisations run campaigns to try to shift votes towards those parties. So in Victoria, it failed dramatically. So Not Happy Dan, you might have seen this campaign. That was all of the same coalition. They did very, very badly. Give 'em the Flick was the campaign they ran in Queensland in the state election. They did better up there.
Mm. Leslie, we're nearly out of time. What would you encourage our listeners to look out for? And when they approach the ballot paper at the coming election, what are the tests that they should put in place to weed out the gun lobby?
I would always steer away from the single issue candidates on this, unless they have been explicit in their commitment to upholding the National Firearms Agreement, then to keep the National Firearms Agreement. The two major parties are still the safest, and so I'm not going to say you have to vote Labor or you have to vote Liberal.
Of course.
The two mainstream parties in Australia are supportive of the National Firearms Agreement, and I don't believe
the National
one
Party.
Of them, No, I believe there are significant members within the National Party who would make changes to
their
the
deputy
National
leader,
Party.
Who actually lives in Elwood.
Yes, we know those,
right? Yeah. You know, is a very heavy supporter of guns. I support, with the right regulation, farmers
absolutely
who need it. The whole sporting shooting thing, I think, and you know, no doubt I'll be attacked for this. It's a bit of a furphy. Right. At the end of the day, people join a gun club so they can get a license. Right? How often are the
the gun clubs make a lot of money too.
Yeah. How often are the attendance records and everything else checked? And, you know, guns kill people, they say. Right. Sorry, they say guns don't kill people, people kill people. Well, you know what? Guns don't fire themselves.
I think it's just like in the US. The US, every time there is a gun, there's a massacre, the NRA says it's people with mental health problems. Well, this is my message. Every country has people with mental health problems. It's the US who arms them.
Yes.
You know, and we are very careful. One of the things that we do is that people who have mental health problems are not in a position to have guns.
Yeah.
That's part of it. It's about having a reason and regulating and overseeing it. I agree with you.
Leslie, great conversation this morning.
Thank you.
If any of our listeners want to learn more about this stuff, where can they go?
So there are two organisations that the Alana and Madeline, we're a children's charity. We absolutely care about this issue, but there is the Australian Gun Safety Alliance,
yes.
Terrific organisation which has brought together public health associations, UNICEF, domestic violence, a whole group of organisations who say that our gun laws are important and they want to defend.
And the other organisation
is Gun Control Australia. Gun Control Australia is a technical group and they know so much about the impact of gun law changes in Australia. Both really important organisations.
Australian Gun Safety Alliance and Gun Control Australia. Thank you very much
My
for your
pleasure.
Time this morning, Leslie. Great to have you in
yes,
the studio.
Thank you.
Keep up the great work.
Stick to it.
And we might ask you to come back in after the election and do a bit of an analysis.
You keep up the great work too, Joy. You make such an important thing for our community. We really appreciate you being there and being the voice for us. Thank you
very much.
Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9, proudly sponsored by Virgin Australia. Visit virginaustralia.com.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.